Well, good afternoon. My name is Christopher Schlecht, and I'm continuing my series in Church and Family in Modern America. I had previously talked about the church and gendered change in the church. I want to move towards gendered change in the family in these next two talks, which will come right on the heels one after the other. It goes without saying that we live in a time of confusion about marriage and child rearing. We've been talking about the breakdown of the traditional family since the 1960s. But our culture today is riddled with men who have no qualms about having sexual relations with a woman and yet no sense of responsibility afterward for the child that may or may not have been produced from that union. There are also plenty of women who have no qualms whatsoever about consorting with that kind of guy. Of course, we know that there are many people in our culture who not only condone same-sex romances, but look upon them as legitimate subjects of marriage, and the Supreme Court has said so. We've reached a point where the laws in our land insist that we call those relationships marriages. And in many instances, we see the church condoning and participating, orchestrating these developments. And as distressing as these trends may be, I want to raise a concern in another direction. Of course, I am concerned about what people customarily refer to as the breakdown of the traditional family. I think we all are. But I want to push my concern in a different direction. I'm concerned about our defenses of the traditional family. What is the traditional family? Whose tradition are we embracing? What tradition are we standing for? Is that tradition, whatever that might be, is that tradition informed by Scripture? Now, whenever someone dislikes a condition in their own culture, a common tactic is to contrast that trend in their own time with how things used to be. The more starkly I can play up the contrast between the now and the past, the more effective is my critique of the now. This is how historical narratives of cultural decline draw their energy. Every age has its moralists who, for whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, do not like something they see in the world around them. The past is one of the most common weapons that people use to attack the present with. Moralists love to use the past as a billy club to beat the present. And so the past gets elevated to this high moral plane. The past becomes some sort of moral norm that we're supposed to measure against our behavior. Moralists need to puff the past in order to carry forward their project of critiquing the present. I want to guard against this kind of reasoning. We see this kind of reasoning in a number of places. The Israelites look back as they were in the wilderness. They actually described slavery in Egypt as a land flowing with milk and honey. Puffing up the past as a way to criticize their present situation, because they kind of got tired of the manna and the quail, I guess, of God's provision. When you see the broken families around us today, don't call for a return to the traditional family as the solution. I think we should reject a lot of what is called the traditional family. It may be praised in country music songs, but not in Scripture. So I want to walk through some of the history of the 20th century and the history of the family in the 20th century. I think a careful look at the past three or four generations should actually make us suspicious of the traditional family and expose warnings against returning to it. But I need to preface my historical account by telling you what you do need to look out for is how traditional values have been used to subvert biblical values. We entered the 20th century thinking of ourselves as largely a Protestant nation. And by the 1950s, we had substituted our Protestantism with a vague civic religion that we called Judeo-Christian. Of course, the idea that the United States is imbued with Judeo-Christian values is a late 20th century notion. We were Protestant, and then Judeo-Christianity developed largely through World War II patriotism, because we didn't want to divide along religious lines. And so rather than Protestant, we became a tri-faith nation, Jew, Catholic, and Protestant. In fact, coming out of World War II and into the Cold War, of course, we were fighting the Soviets, and we were fighting them with two things. You see, because the Russians, those are godless atheists, and so we are a faithful America. We love God. And the Russians have no consumer choices. And so freedom means to look at all the stuff we can buy. And so we have our faith and we have our consumption and consumer choices. And we fought the Cold War preeminently on these fronts. We had other fronts as well. This is why it's in the 1950s when the phrase, "In God We Trust," actually becomes adopted as our national motto, and it's mandated to be put on United States coinage. That's why in the 1950s, the phrase, "Under God," is added to the Pledge of Allegiance. Prior to that time, back in the 1920s, kids would say, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all." Oh, we add "one nation under God" in the 1950s because we're fighting those Ruskies and they're atheists. And of course, because this is imbued with consumer choices as well, this gets echoed in Hollywood. To promote his blockbuster Ten Commandments movie, producer Cecil B. DeMille partnered with the Fraternal Order of the Eagles and funded the dedication of stone tablets for display at city halls, county courthouses, state capitals, and public parks all around the country. So here we see, for example, on the left, one of these dedication ceremonies. This is actor Yul Brynner speaking at one of these dedications. It was Paramount Pictures, of course, funding the Ten Commandments out in Austin, Texas, that Ted Cruz is so proud to have defended. This was the group, this was a gift to the city of Austin in 1961 as in connection with the promotion of the Ten Commandments movie. The so-called heyday of traditional values. By this time, the church really had become pretty weak. And I want to level a critique against then the 20th century family. I use these other illustrations to start to interrogate the past a little bit and how we tend to elevate the 1950s and say, my, how things have changed, how bad it is now, and the constructed image of purity on the past is oftentimes a figment of our constructed imaginations because we don't like how things are today. And so we're inappropriately, I think, selective in the things that we choose to remember about the past. So, in order to set this up here, I want to think about manhood and womanhood in particular. I think these are topics that I've been discussing here, manhood and womanhood, and traditional gender roles in the traditional family of the 20th century. Now, of course, to go to a wider context, the modern world witnessed the craftsman being replaced by the manufacturer. And a craftsman sees a whole project through from start to finish, but a manufacturer divides projects into component parts, discrete little tasks that are simpler and easier to handle than the whole project. It requires far less skill to perform a little task than to carry out the entire project. How would you think of a guy who goes into his garage and comes out with a car that he created in his garage versus a guy who can stand on an assembly line and put a left rear quarter panel onto a car? I think the level of impressiveness is quite different. That's the difference between the manufacturer and craftsmanship. Okay? It takes craftsmen years to master their trades. Years of experience that fetch a good wage, but any oaf can perform a task on an assembly line, and oafs are cheap. So the modern world produced specializations that didn't used to exist. Accountants emerged in the 1870s, the same decade my own field, history, emerged as a professional specialization. moderns approached human history the way Henry Ford was going to, a little later, approach the manufacture of his Model A. First, you divide the whole project into its component parts, isolate the problems, objectives, issues, and most importantly, the rules that arise within each component. You see, we conquer our callings by dividing them, separating out each calling from other callings. Now, this is going to impact our understanding of family life and callings within the family. About 150 years ago, a generation of men went off to work, and this was a recent development. Home life and work life came to be seen as separate, specialized spheres. In the later 20th century, a number of factors, including proliferation of automobiles, the easy transportation they provided, the division of property into small little parcels and cheap government loans, produced the suburbs, as you see here. The migration of Americans from cities or farms into suburbs is one of the most important demographic shifts that takes place in the 20th century. It's a shift that took place in my own parents' lifetime. This produced the modern home. Home was distinct from where you shop, from where you work, from where you are educated, from where you transact commerce. It was a specialized place, narrowly conceived. It was like a left rear quarter panel, right? One of the worst consequences of this was the advent of the modern suburban housewife and the tragic willingness of 20th century Christians to substitute the biblical calling for wives and daughters for a vision that looks more like June Cleaver. In the modern context, the woman's place as the home should be a repugnant expression to Christian parents who want to prepare their daughters to face the world. Because home has come to be understood as one of these specialized spaces, cordoned off, bracketed off from other sorts of real life. And I'd like to examine now how this modern version of the traditional family, so I call it the modern traditional family, and I hope you see the irony in that. The modern traditional family, and let's see how it fared in throughout some of the periods of the 20th century. And I'm going to spend the rest of my time finishing out this lecture and then in the next one, kind of marching through the 20th century and interrogating the traditional family and see how it does. And to invite ourselves to reflect on whether or not this suggests an answer of something we should go back to when we confront today's problems and challenges. All right. And I want to begin then with the Great Depression. Okay, I can't march through the entirety of the 20th century, but the 1930s is a good place to start. It picks us up from where we were last time talking about the church. Here is the account of a wife, the personal account of a wife describing family life in the Great Depression. Here's what she says. My husband was a sheet metal worker. He'd been working steady, but when the hard times came, he was just off and on, off and on. I got a job helping out in a grocery store across from a school, made sandwiches for the kids during their lunch hour, made a little money that way, and got some good sandwiches for my own kids. Otherwise, my kids made bean sandwiches, just mashed up beans and put them between bread. I don't think we ate salad in those days. We had radishes or green onions right out of the garden, but we never seemed to have salad. We ate lots of macaroni and spaghetti, and I could make 3 pounds of hamburger go a long way. I used to mix a pound of butter with a pound of margarine, and if I didn't tell them, people didn't know the difference. And I didn't tell them. I figured every which way I could to make ends meet. I turned shirt collars, watched for specials, and some of them ends just wouldn't meet. They just couldn't be stretched far enough to meet. I did what I had to do. I seemed to always find a way to make things work. Now, so that's the end of the quote. Notice that the housewife's creativity and industry contributed significantly to the hardship of the Depression, to helping the family through the Depression. But notice the contrast with her husband who was unemployed. I'm picking up where I left off now. So this is still the woman speaking here. I did what I had to do. I seemed to always find a way to make things work. I think hard times is harder on a man, because a woman will do something. Women just seem to know where they can save or where they can help more than a man. It's just a worry for him. He feels it terrible when he can't take care of his family. My husband got very despondent, you know. Oh, he'd say that you can't have this or you're not getting that, and I don't want to hear about this. Just fighting against it all the time. A woman, like I said, can take more. Now, away from the quote again, lurking behind the hardship is the notion that the woman's place is the home and the man's calling is away from the home. I want you to notice that. In the context of widespread unemployment, men who are deprived of a job can't do anything about it. A woman's sphere remained intact. She could do things that had a positive impact, but a man was left to do nothing because home was not his calling. You see that? The overtight and inflexible notion of what a man's role was meant to be and what a woman's role is meant to be lurks back behind the context to create this difficulty. So, here's an account of the Patterson family that was kept by a social worker at the time who took a number of interviews. So this is a social worker who interviewed the Pattersons. Prior to the Depression, Mr. Patterson was an inventory clerk earning from $35 to $40 a week. He lost his job in 1931. At the present time, he does not earn anything, while his 18-year-old girl gets $12.50 a week working at Woolworths, and his wife has part-time work cleaning a doctor's office. Unemployment and depression have hit Mr. Patterson much more than the rest of the family. They've hit Mr. Patterson much more than the rest of the family. The hardest thing about unemployment, Mr. Patterson says, is the humiliation within the family. It makes him feel very useless to have his wife and daughter bring in a little money to the family while he does not contribute a nickel. It's awful to him because now the tables are turned. That is, he has to ask his daughter for a little money for tobacco. He would rather walk miles than ask for car fare money. His daughter would want him to have it, but he cannot bring himself to ask for it. He feels more irritable and morose than he ever did in life. He doesn't enjoy eating. He hasn't slept in months. He lies awake and tosses, wondering what he will do and what will happen to them if he doesn't ever get any work anymore. He feels that there is nothing to wake up for in the morning and nothing to live for. He often wonders what would happen if he put himself out of the picture or just got out of the way of his wife. Perhaps she and the girl would get along better without him. He blames himself for being unemployed while he tries all day long to find work and would take anything. He feels that he would be successful if he had taken advantage of his opportunities in youth and had secured an education. Mr. Patterson believes his wife and daughter have adjusted themselves to the depression better than he has. In fact, sometimes they seem so cheerful in the evening that he can't stand it anymore. He grabs his hat and says that he's going out for a while, and he walks hard for an hour and comes home again. This is one thing he never did before unemployment. He is so nervous and jumpy now that he has to do something like that to prevent himself from exploding. Now, this is the social worker's account of Mr. Patterson. Okay. He's unemployment and at home, that's not his calling, but he is at home because he's unemployed, and so he's worthless and he feels it. He feels it deeply. The social worker describes Mrs. Patterson and her experience of the Depression, and we see the tensions that beset the family. Mrs. Patterson says that they have not felt the Depression so terribly themselves or changed their way of living so very much. The wife thinks that it is her husband's fault he's unemployed. He has become irritable and very hard to get along with. He talks of nothing else and isn't interested in anything else but troubles. She and her daughter try to forget troubles and have a good time once in a while, but he just sits and broods. Of course, that makes her impatient with him. She can't sit at home and keep him company, so that during the past couple of years, she and her daughter just go out together without him. It isn't that they leave him out. He just isn't interested and stays at home. Okay. Now, back again to Mr. Patterson. I want you to notice this dynamic here. I want you to listen carefully to what happened to this marriage during the Depression. Of course, scarcity was a huge concern, but scarcity shouldn't wreck a family. Scarcity should not wreck a family. We take wedding vows to love one another in plenty and in want. I would argue that the family problems that arose in the Great Depression, and those problems were indeed widespread, were problems brought about by false expectations that flowed from an unhealthy modernist conception of the absolute separation of men's roles from women's roles. Back to Mr. Patterson. Mr. Patterson insists that his child is as sweet as ever and tries to cheer him up, but the tenor of his conversation about his wife is different. She does go out more with the daughter, leaving him alone. He cannot stand it, worrying as he does, and having them lighthearted. When you're not bringing any money, you don't get as much attention. She doesn't nag all the time the way some women do, he says, but he knows she blames him for being unemployed. He intimates that they have fewer sex relations. It's nothing that I do or don't do, no change in me, but when I tell her I want more love, she just gets mad. It comes about gradually, he said. He cannot point definitively to any time when he noticed the difference in her, but he knows that his advances are rebuffed now when they would have been rebuffed now when they would not have been before the hard times. So the modern family separated men and women according to the tasks that they perform. And unemployment took away the so-called men's tasks. And so the only so-called women's tasks remained. The problem lay in the insistence upon telling men and women apart by the particular tasks that they perform in the home and in the marketplace. Now, of course, the Bible teaches that husbands and wives are different, that men and women are different. But it's not enough merely to insist that they are different, as important as that is. We need to search the scriptures and examine how to reckon the difference. Masculinity and femininity are really and objectively distinct, but we recognize the distinction not by examining masculinity all alone by itself on the one hand, and on the other by considering femininity all alone by itself. The Bible teaches us to discern masculinity and femininity by seeing how they work together and how they play off of one another. They set the context, each one for the other. Nobody would ever ask whether a particular musical note, let's say a B flat, always has to play the part of a melody in a song. We all know that a B flat note might represent a melody, but we also know that at a later point in the same song, it might not be the melody, it could be the harmony. When I say this, I'm not introducing any confusion to the obvious distinction between melody and harmony. How do you distinguish melody from harmony? You distinguish them by listening to the way they interact with one another within the life of the song. You do not tell them apart according to their absolute position on the musical scale. And so it is with masculinity and femininity. In a healthy community, you should always be able to tell the boys and the girls apart. But the way you tell them apart is by watching the music of their interaction. You don't do it in the modern way by limiting boys to some tasks and girls to other tasks, boys to some spheres and girls to others. We understand what masculinity is by studying it in conjunction with femininity. A study like what is masculinity, I think, is a fruitful project when it's undertaken in and of itself. You need to, what are masculinity and femininity? They're understood together, like melody and harmony understood together. And both voices in a fugue can change and still keep up a good fugue. Masculinity and femininity shift notes, but that's not always a bad thing. All right, so I would suggest that some of the family hardships that beset us during the Great Depression were wrought of certain assumptions about the modern family and rendered the women having access to tools that the men did not have access to simply because of this hardened wooden notion, fragmentation of life, and assign them to their different places. Kind of like telling men, man, you can only sing a B flat. That's all you can do. And so if you change some of the situation or surrounding context, I'm stuck on the B flat. That's what we saw with the families that we interacted with here. All right, now I want, in order to develop this even further, I want to move into World War II, which is just a few years down the road here, just a couple years down the road, which was another time of hardship that came immediately on the heels of the Great Depression. World War II is a time period when the distinction between masculinity and femininity was, for the most part, upheld. This is interesting. This World War II, I will submit to you, was not an era of gendered confusion, yet it was an era when some of the roles, the physical places and jobs changed. Nobody mistakes this person for a male. This is Rosie the Riveter. Look at her, she's made up, and she's even got a man's shirt on, but it actually acts, the juxtaposition of it accentuates her femininity. It's widely understood, widely recognized, that we see the presence of women in new contexts during World War II. What I want to point out once again is that this did not trouble gender lines, which once again comes back to what I was suggesting about the Great Depression, is that to move some of these tasks around doesn't necessarily disturb the gender distinctions. It only disturbs the gender distinctions if we talk about left rear quarter panels are for boys and right headlights are for girls. That's the only way it might disturb the gender distinctions. And I want to unpack this here. I want to unpack this. This was not a tragedy of gender. And it's often portrayed as such, but I think a closer look, closer scrutiny will tell a different story than what's commonly understood. So here we have women in the Boeing plant in Seattle, women making Army and Navy equipment. I want to argue that women entering the workplace was not the feminist victory that many claim it to be. And I'll illustrate this before I get to the workplace, but illustrate it with other facets of cultural developments that occurred in World War II. For example, cheerleaders. Cheerleading was an inherently masculine, it was a guy thing from the advent of college football. And so, think about this, leading big crowds of people in yelling loudly traditional guy stuff. These are the Yale cheerleaders. But what happens when you send a bunch of guys over there, over in Europe to fight or over in the Pacific to fight? Well, you still got to have your college football. And so you're going to see women actually increasingly occupying the role of cheerleader. Okay? Women in a man's role. And so we start to see some women cheerleaders. Now, is it hard to tell? Boy, these are he-men, aren't they? They look so masculine. To suggest that is absurd. They don't look masculine. These are women cheerleaders. And it brings us now to where cheerleaders are today, right near us, Washington State University. No one's going to confuse these people with males. In fact, they are attired so as to accentuate the fact that these bodies are not male bodies, but rather that they are female bodies. We see the same thing developing in World War II in baseball. Some of you have probably seen the movie with Rosie O'Donnell and Madonna, A League of Their Own, Tom Hanks. It's kind of a fun movie that repopularized the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, which really was a thing popular prominently in the Midwest. we see these women who are playing baseball because there was sort of a little bit less baseball going. I mean, Joe DiMaggio was over there fighting, you know, and so anyways, we have women's entertainment, women playing baseball. And in order to put these women out on the baseball field, they actually went to many of them in their mannerisms, didn't quite conform to conventions and gestures of womanhood. They went to charm school. They learned about makeup and poise and address and this sort of thing. And they were told that they had to slide, but nonetheless, they had to wear these skirts so that no one would confuse these women baseball players with male baseball players. So here we have women playing a sport that we're used to seeing guys play, but the femininity of these individuals is being underscored, reinforced, even though they're doing or performing a new and different task, just like cheerleading. Here's from Life magazine, girls baseball. And coming back now to employment and work, this is what we're more familiar with. Images of women, of course, do the job that he left behind. There's an attachment of sort of a normalcy for men to occupy the job here that's assumed. You're doing the job that he left behind. Because the men are fighting, the women are part of the infrastructure back home. The more women at work, the sooner we win. Women are needed, and look at all of these tasks that women are needed to sign up in your local employment service. I will pay more than top legal prices. Women continue to shop too, and women will not participate in a black market. I will pay no more than legal prices, and so part of the rationing program. So women are going to be shoppers just as they are on factory floors. So rationing, interestingly enough, we've got women who are shoppers here. But then we have gardening. And of course, if a lot of our agricultural products are going to supply the war effort, we need to garden at home so we don't, the domestic population doesn't serve that. One thing that's not as widely recognized is agricultural work to serve the war effort, not simply industrial munitions factories type work, but agricultural work. The women's land army, food comes first. And we see trying to recruit women to the farm fields, to become farm hands. Obviously, traditional men's type work, join the women's land army. Women were being summoned to do tasks that were traditionally attributed to men. Of course, now women are not summoned to the war front here. And this is the Navy makes men. We see that, okay, notice, he's a man, right? This is not a man. But she's joining the Marines, nonetheless. U.S. Cadet Nurse Corps, or joining the U.S. military. You can be a cadet nurse. Look at how these women are attired. They actually enlisted, the U.S. War Department enlisted enlisted fashion designers to create different silhouettes for women's uniforms and all of their promotional posters to bring women in the military to assure them that coming into the military does not mean that you're becoming masculine. It does not mean that you're becoming masculine. What it means is that we need to assert femininity in a new role, in a new place, in a new job. But there's no blurring of gender distinction going on here. I mean, do these guys look like men? Like, join the military. This is what this is. Join the military. Join the military again. U.S. Marine Corps. This is a United States Marine in World War II. You see the fashion design here. And of course, by becoming a Marine, you free a man to fight. And women are going to be supplying all kinds of very important roles that are vital for the war effort to free up men to do the actual fighting. And many of those support roles are military roles. The very design, the very design is of their clothing, reinforces that. I love this. I found this in an archives. This was at Washington State University's archives. And of course, recruiting heavily on college campuses. both men and women, but especially women on college campuses here. I am interested in the U.S. Marine Corps Women's Reserve. It's really interesting. This is one side of the brochure, and then they get to the inside of the brochure, how you'll look. So they join the Marine Corps, and of course the question is, you're interested in how am I going to look here? Well, when the sun is warm, you're going to be wearing these kind of clothes, and when the cool wind blows, you're going to be wearing those kind of clothes. This catering to or reassuring women in certain conventions of femininity in order to get them to join the United States Marine Corps in World War II. And of course, the upshot is that you're freeing a Marine to fight by you yourself becoming a Marine. Lady, attention for all out loveliness. Now, this becomes very interesting. Cosmetics producers actually created new hues of lipstick to match military uniforms. So that you could be sure that you looked really feminine in your military uniform. Elizabeth Arden produced Montezuma Red. Notice this is a black and white ad that has the red being highlighted to show that it's going to accompany the military uniform. And I'll read the text on the ad. Elizabeth Arden's newest lipstick color, Montezuma Red, inspired by the brave true red of the hat cord scarf and chevrons of the women in the Marines. A vivid red to wear with black, white, gray, beige, navy, and tweeds, a tribute to some of the bravest men and women in the world. So, wear this shade of lipstick for victory. Again, I'm using this hopefully through a heaping up of examples, visual examples. You can see that we have women occupying roles that conventionally or tradition assigned to men, but there's no deprivation of femininity. In fact, femininity is asserting itself. Gender difference is asserting itself in the midst of these changes in sort of function, changes in function. We see certain conventions of femininity being reinforced again and again and again. If you look at all this wartime stuff, it's not gendered confusion, it's reinforcing gender difference again and again and again. That's what you see very starkly here. So, stockings, of course, with perspiration. Cigarette advertisements, this is interesting. Selling Chesterfield cigarettes, and the pretty girl, the pretty and sophisticated woman is the one who is wearing the outfit of a military officer. We see this is a Camel cigarette ad as well. First in fashion, this is fascinating, fashion. It's fashionable to be in the military. You can wear these kinds of clothes and you're smoking your Camel cigarettes. Here she is, of course, heading out for the evening with her. This is nail polish. These women, 1944's best dressed, their favorite Q-Tex shade, and it goes through the whole, all the women's auxiliaries of the various branches of the United States military. I love this one. I found this in Mademoiselle magazine. I do go through things like Cosmopolitan and Mademoiselle from the 1940s because that is my idea of a good time. I love this ad, doing man's work, retaining women's loveliness. The ad reads, "You too, like thousands of other women, can do men's work without sacrificing one bit of feminine loveliness." And the play on that is fascinating. "The secret is to ensure a lovely line, be fitted to a form fit tailored to precision, foundation, girdle, or bra. The better stores have them." The form fit underclothing, because if you're going to be working out at the Boeing plant putting together, B-17 bombers, you want to look like a woman while you're doing that. And so you need to have a certain kind of underclothing that factory jumpsuit that you're wearing is going to preserve your femininity here. So it's fascinating then. We see this in ad after ad after take a beauty shortcut, find your new way of life. And so we have got the woman in the home, but the woman on the factory, women in clerical office, so forth. We see this once again in example after example after example. Now, I want to bring this in for a landing here. We've talked about the 1930s and the 1940s, the Depression and World War II, eras of deprivation, not that far apart. We're only talking about 15 years of history here. But the challenge of the Great Depression created strains on the family, I would submit to you, it's because it has something to do with this false construct of there's certain work that guys need to keep their hands off of and other work that women have to keep their hands off of and that guys can do, and vice versa, this hard-lined separation, which allowed women to kind of deal with some of the problems in the Depression, whereas men could not. They weren't allowed to be part of the solution. If you're unemployed and your job is to, woman's place is the home, right? That's not the men's place. And your place is at work, and if there's unemployment, then you're stuck. And that's what traditional values gave us. Well, the wartime distress was another distressful time period, a different kind of distress. In some ways, it was a deeper distress. But we see a reaffirmation of masculinity and femininity that adapted itself to men and women in different places and different locales, something we didn't see happening so much in the Great Depression. Masculinity and femininity were not threatened. There was not gendered confusion in World War II context. Okay. But as we move forward, and we'll see this in the next lecture, but as we move forward in the post-war context, I think we're going to see some troubling signs resurface. And I actually want to turn to, I'm going to begin next time with World War II and looking at some other facets of World War II that I think were troubling, that were genuine threats to the family, but the threats didn't come by way of an assault on masculinity and femininity. Those threats to the family came in other ways as well. So that's what we'll take up next time. And for now, we'll take a break. Thank you.